despised life where work under heaven is grief. So all is in vain, chasing wind, disbelief. I hated my labors, which under the sun, to one after me I would pass in this run. Ecclesiastes, that was chapter 2, verses 17 and 18 in the version of Yours Truly from 2020. I think it's good that I went by the pen name Rolf Ward Green, because it's a rather unique name, and so when you search for Rolf Ward Green, you're more likely to find my publications. Of course, you can search for the publication name as well, but my name being Rolf Ward Green is more identifiable than Ward Green is, because the word Ward is very common in the world for other reasons, and the word Green is very common. So Rolf Ward Green is a lot less common, and the word Ralph would be not very common either. So Rolf Ward Green is preferable to my given name, Ralph Ward Green. So anyway, that's something I thought was worth mentioning. Let's read chapter 2, paragraph 2 of the article, The Ark of Urartu, shall we, little children, for today? We've done our daily scripture from Ecclesiastes 2, 17, 18. Shennong is the emperor of the five grains, or posthumously, he was called Yan Di, the flame emperor. That's a picture of him right here. Interestingly, he's portrayed as having horns. And the reason why we think Shennong, well, we know that Shennong, according to Chinese tradition, fought with a certain Chinese enemy that he had. And what was his name? Let me see. Qi Yu was the enemy of Shennong, and we identified Qi Yu as Nimrod. But the reason for all of that is because Shennong is identified in the generational sequence. He comes in line with Shelah. And Shelah and Shennong both begin with the SH sound. So it's not far-fetched. There are other similarities we're going to be looking at too. But Shennong, the other reason that we say that we think Shelah fought with Nimrod is because Shennong fought with Qi Yu. Qi Yu corresponding to Nimrod, or seeming to. I mean, the Chinese mythology is really mythological, and I mean, it goes back to the first emperor, who they called Noah. Or Nua. They call the first emperor Noah, then they're obviously going back right to the beginning of the post-flood world, right? With, I'm going to look up here. Where is it? Let's see, what do we have? What? That's not right. We had, there it is. Okay, good. Should have been easier to find, I thought. And it was easy, but I'm just looking for the Chinese rulers. So the PDF file, when I restored it from the old version of the Wikipedia article, this is the old version of it, it did show Noah as being the first emperor of China. Obviously he wasn't an emperor, right? He wasn't. In fact, she was actually a woman in the Chinese mythology and called the empress, not the emperor. So it was a woman called Nua. But you see, mythology confounds everything. So we don't have to worry about it. The fact that it was actually exactly the right number of generations from Noah, his son Shem, his son Arpakshad, his son Cainan. So Cainan is Fushi, and he fits perfectly because Fushi is also very closely identified in the mythology of China with Kangji, and Kangji is a name similar to Cainan. So Fushi and cations seem to fit really well together, and the right number of generations exists between Noah and Cainan. There's Shem, Arpachshad, Cainan. Exactly the right number. And then Shelah is next, and he corresponds to Shinong. So if by the time, you know, Cainan was born, we have the rulership of Fushi in beginning in 2852, according to the Chinese. It's virtually a mythology, but it has chronology, which makes it history, right? So if his reign started in 2852, and we have Fushi corresponding to Cainan, who was born in 3145, so he could have been certainly ruling in 2852, since he died many years later in 2685. He lived for 460 years, according to the Septuagint. So Cainan could have actually been an emperor, and he could have been living in China for all we know, like it's possible. The reason why we say that, too, is because there's a story about, in the Book of Jubilees, it talks about this, that Cainan found these signs. I think we read that yesterday, or the day before, where he read these things. It's fascinating to try and understand it, but it's so long ago and so confused. The Book of Jubilees says that the son of Arpachshad, who was Cainan, that Cainan, he was the one who found this writing, which was a signful or sinful record of the watchers of the heavens. So, yeah, but it says he talked to Noah about it, so he wasn't in China apparently at the time, because Noah, we believe, lived in Turkey after the landing of the Ark until his death. He lived there. But let's keep reading now. When I was a little girl, this is when my wife, I believe, wrote this or told this story. My late wife, Anne, she told this story. When I was a little girl, she said, my father took his binder out to the fields to cut the grain, and he bound it into sheaves. I don't even really remember where the story came from, but I think it was from my late wife. The sheaves were then formed into stooks and left to dry. When the sheaves were dry, then they were gathered up onto the racks, and the men took them to the thrashing machine, pitched them into its mouth to separate the grain from the straw, and the grain was stored in the granaries or carted by wagon 8 miles on a dirt road to the local elevator. That's the end of that story. And I just thought it was good to include, because Shinong is known as the emperor of the five grains, and he would be the one that we see corresponding to Shelah in our genealogy of the generations. Yan Di, or Shinong, is the one we're saying is Shelah, and he had the same sounding syllable as the end of Kang Yan. Yan Di, Kang Yan. And he's a kinsman. Okay. Why do we mention Kang Yan? Because Kang Yan was Kangyan Mountain in the title of chapter 2. All right. But Shinong is a kinsman of the Yellow Emperor and had for his enemy the Jiuli tribesman, Chiyu, whom we identify with the biblical Nimrod. Cainan's son Shelah. So since Shinong had an enemy called Chiyu, who seems to be similar to Nimrod, therefore we say, you know, Shelah, who seems to correspond to Shinong, was probably an enemy of Nimrod, and the proof of that is that very often enemies in history married the daughters of their enemy. So, and that's what happened according to the Book of Jubilees, that Shelah married the daughter of Nimrod. Cainan's son Shelah, according to the genealogy, is born in 3014, right here, BCE. And where were we? And Shela means in the Aramaic, this is interesting, to send, sprout, shoot, or missile, or weapon. The Book of Jubilees, chapter 8, verse 6. Now, Yan in the Chinese means flame, and Shenong is spirit, right? Which is also Shen in quotes, in brackets there. Okay, the Shen, okay. The spirit is the Shen part of Shenong, and the farming is the Nong part of Shenong. So Shenong means spirit of farming, or something like that. And Shela means sprout. That's interesting, because sprout seems to be related to spirit, too. Without vowels, sprout and spirit both become S-P-R-T. The four consonants of those two words are identical. So, spirit and sprout, it's the same thing. Is the date of Shenong consistent with Shela's 3014 or 3014 BCE? Incredibly, yeah, it's amazing. Shenong is said to have lived 5,000 years ago in Wikipedia at the time I wrote this article, and so he may be dated to 2991 BCE, a year in which Shela was 22 years old, because he was born in 3014 BCE, 22 years after, yeah, I don't mind doing it, 3014 minus 2991 is 23. Yeah, right. So 22 years and some months or whatever, you know, it's 23, close enough, 22. Han Chinese take Wan Di and Shenong as their ancestors. Who's Huang Di or Wan Di? Who is Wan Di? Well, it's the same as Yan Di, it looks like to me. The, wait a minute. Who's Yan Di? Wait a minute. Yan Di is Shenong, but Huang Di is the Yellow Emperor, I believe. Yeah, I believe that Huang Di is the, if we look down in the chart, Huang Di is Eber, and that's the Yellow Emperor. He's the emperor following Yan Di, but he's not mentioned here by the name Yellow Emperor, but that's what he is. His name was Gongsun Xuanyuan. Xuanyuan. Gongsun Xuanyuan. Or Eber is what we're calling him, according to the generations of the Bible. He fits perfectly well with Eber, and that's the Yellow Emperor, Huang Di. We don't give the different names of the emperors, like Yan Di's the Flame Emperor. In this table, we don't give the emperor's names or titles like that for the different emperors. But in this chart here, we could see maybe, maybe not. We see this is the Wikipedia article from the older version of it. We could see, what was Fuxi called? Oh, we can't click on it. Okay. Because we'd have to look it up. This is just, I don't know what's, where it's going to take us. We can go to Wikipedia and look up Fuxi and see what we find. Let's look up Fuxi and see what it says now. What nowadays they're saying about Fuxi, just to see whether he's a cultural hero. Oh, even in the Bible, okay, even in the Chinese mythology, he is actually the husband of Nua in the Chinese mythology. So, it's a mythology. Because it's a mythology, it's confused. All the generations are confused, whereas we can see, we can look at it as a generational thing. so that Fuxi is a generation that comes later. But it's in mythology, everything is all confused, totally confused very often, right? And this is another case where it is. He's actually the husband of Nua. And Nua is the first emperor of China, according to this Wikipedia table from years ago. So Fuxi, Nua, this is according to the Chinese documents, that it was researched, and the references are given here in the at the bottom of the table. Everything was done, but then they decided to remove it from Wikipedia for reasons we don't fully understand. So we would rather use it because it is of great importance in trying to understand the ancient people of whom we're writing. But see, Fuxi, he's credited with the Kanji system of writing, so he's the same person as Kanji as well. He's credited with writing and inventing the system of writing, and also he was said to be the official historian of the Yellow Emperor. That's interesting too. The Yellow Emperor is Wang Di, as I was just saying. So we're done our study now, I think, for today. We saw that yesterday, for example, we saw that the Kunlun Mountains on the Tibetan Plateau were the place where the Yellow River began to flow to the east of the Kunlun Mountains into China and ended up in Hebei on the east side of China. And the name Hebei seems to correspond well with the name Heber also. And the Yellow River, of course, corresponds with the Yellow Emperor. So we have the very earliest emperor of China there were earlier emperors who were not really emperors. They weren't living in China, in the case of Noah, for example, or Shem. We don't think Shem lived in China. And Arpakshad, I don't think we know where he lived. And Fuxi, perhaps he did live in China. And, well, he was Kainan. Perhaps Kainan lived in China, I mean. And then after him, Shila, his son, perhaps he lived in China too. But no, because he fought. Yeah, they lived in Shinar, perhaps. And that's where Shinong, who was Shila, fought with Nimrod. That would mean they were still, at that time, in Shinar. But then the Yellow Emperor, perhaps at that point, they had moved to China from Shinar at that point, after the battle with Nimrod, after the dividing of the nations, the splitting, the dividing of the earth, the confusion of the languages at the Tower of Babel in 2745 BCE. It was after that that Shinong became emperor of China, according to this, 2737. So it fits in the sense, it's not whether it fits or not, because we don't have any information other than this. It's not a question of does it fit. It gives us the information that at some point, just after the confusion at the Tower of Babel, this son of Shem, or descendant of Shem, or some of his generations after Shem, some of those generations moved to China, one of whom was the Yellow Emperor, whom we call Heber in the Bible. And that's Huang Di here. Eber or Heber. And his father was Shila, who fought with Nimrod in Shinar. And Shinar and China, of course, are very, very similar sounding names. It's such a fascinating thing to try to understand how they moved to China and they kept calling it the same name as Shinar, where the Tower of Babel was built. And they still kept the story all the way back to Noah in their emperors. The story back to the first emperor being Noah was preserved in the mythology, even though the gender was wrong for that person. And, you know, all the story was all intermingled and confused of all of these Chinese emperors who were the earliest of the emperors. That's the end of our study for today in chapter 2, paragraph 2 of the Ark of Urartu. I've been really busy today. I have so many things I could talk about. I've got a new air conditioner in the basement. It's a new heat pump. It's a heat pump, and I had to try and hook it up. There was a broken piece, but the piece that broke on it is the piece I don't need, I think, at all. Because I don't have the kind of window where I use that sort of plastic part. So the part that was broken into a fairly sizable number of fragments still doesn't appear to be necessary. And I can use it. The box in which the heat pump arrived was in almost perfect condition. I think they just put it upside down and it crushed this one piece. But they didn't drop the box, apparently, because the box was in perfect condition, unless they changed the box. The box was open, but the packing straps had been put on it. So somebody had removed the packing tape. They'd opened the box, put the straps back on. They probably were checking to see what broke. But whatever, I don't think it was damaged, and it's working, pumping out cold air right now. And it's also condensing water and it's being drained into the sump, that extra humidity that it's removing from the air. So I can use it also as a humidifier and also as actually a heat pump that produces heat in the winter. I haven't yet got it working as a heater because they say it takes several minutes before it starts to produce heat when you turn on the heat mode. And I didn't wait long enough, so I didn't see that actually work. I wanted to get the air conditioning working, and it's working really well. It's a 14,000 BTU unit. 14,000 BTUs is bigger than these air conditioners I have upstairs, which I think are maybe 11,000 or something. But I've got two of them running, you know, most of the day they run. They just don't run on maximum for most of the time. We should watch the rest of our the rest of our movie segment, that is. Oh, look at this. Yeah, I found the picture I wanted to show you where Ron is standing by the anchor stones. You can see how big this anchor stone is, and they say that one third of it is underground, so it's even bigger than this. This is one of the drogue stones that they say they've got, of which they say they've got maybe 25 or something. Of these drogue stones, or 26, I think they said they found. They found a lot of these lying around this one city, which is some miles away from where the Ark landed, but it's fairly much in the vicinity, so it's believed that this is definitely one of the stones that was used on Noah's Ark to stabilize the vessel. Now, they talk about hanging these stones off the side of the vessel and so on. But Mr. Windsor, the naval architect, he suggested that the stones would have been suspended from the back or the aft end of the moon pool. So he disagreed with that. Anyway, if we have time, maybe we'll watch some of that. The story of Ron's sons and how Ron and his sons found the Ark site was remarkable because their car broke down at several different places. And they remembered to mark the places where the car broke down with stones. They made a pile of stones at each place where the car broke down. And then when they came back later the next day, or whenever they came back, they found the piles of stones, and they discovered that these piles of stones corresponded to something important in each case. In one case, it was Noah's house that they found nearby to one of the piles of stones. In another case, they found the Ark itself, and I forget what the other one was. Maybe it was the drogue stones or something. But they found value. I mean, they said they never would have found any of these things. They never would have found Noah's Ark, even though they knew it was somewhere in Turkey. They said they never would have found, without a map, they didn't have a map. They never would have found, nobody had made a map, so they never would have found Noah's Ark if they hadn't had these breakdowns in their car that they believe were the working of God. That's the way, see, that's the way God works. He works in these rather interesting ways for believers, right? For believers, interesting things happen that seem to be, you know, discouraging or maybe bad things happening, but they can be utilized as signs from God. And that's what Ron and his family did. They used these things. His sons and Ron, I guess his sons were fairly young at the time. I'm not sure how old they were. But they used these things as signs that they took to be from God. And then they used the information to find the locations that they knew they had no other way of finding. So that's it for that story. Where are we now in the Ra expeditions? We're at maybe 10 minutes or something, I think. Let's go find out. Let's find out where we are before we start. Let me double check where we are here. It's part 2 we did. I think we're on the 10-minute point or something. We'll be at about 10 minutes after having done 2 parts. Yeah, this looks right. So let's see if this... See if we can continue on.
A stone doorway led into a burial chamber over which the entire pyramid had been built. A magnificent stone lid weighing several tons covered a sarcophagus. A splendid mass covered the face of the remains of the Sun King's mummy, the flesh long since rotted away by the action of the jungle's humidity. But some people still argue that Egyptian pyramids are not step-shaped like Mexican, Peruvian, and Polynesian ones. But here again, similarities prevail. There are step-shaped pyramids in Egypt alongside the other kind. Consider the similarities between Egypt and the Americas. The same technique for fitting together huge stone blocks. The same architecture in the pyramid tunnels which support hundreds of thousands of tons overhead. The same burial chambers for divine sun kings in this sarcophagus, where Pharaoh Cheops once lay, and here in the neighboring pyramid lay his son, Pharaoh Khafre. The same step shape of the pyramids as in Mexico, Peru, and Polynesia. Here the world's oldest, Saqqara Pyramid. The same colossal monument to the sun king, and the reed boat. These models in the Cairo Museum were made over 3,000 years ago. They show long-dead fishermen aboard vessels of lashed-together papyrus reeds. Twin oars tied together steer the boats, a mechanism which is neither the simple steering oar nor the true vertical rudder. A bas-relief shows papyrus being cut and transported for use in boat building. Coils of rope bind the reeds together. An extra thick rope runs along the length of the deck. On a large reed boat, the captain, sitting on his cabin roof, commands a crew of 21 men. Many boats had sloping double masts with sails wider at the top than at the bottom, and a complicated rigging which is evidence of a truly sophisticated sailing technique. Ship's provisions consisted of cooked food, dried meat and fruit, live poultry in cages, water and oil in jars, bread in baskets, and beneath the boat, fish which were caught with hook and line. Egyptians living in the Nile Delta had close contact with the Phoenicians and their neighbors, who also built pyramids and worshipped the sun. Carvings from ancient Nineveh show fish swimming under reed boats which curve up at each end. Flat, cut-off sterns are shown on the coastwise boats used inside the reed marshes. We are witnessing an ancient battle. A crab indicates that this is, in fact, the ocean and not a river. Men and women flee from death ashore, out to sea. They are escaping in reed boats, but where to? We do not know. But from Asia Minor and Egypt, cultures spread to the Mediterranean islands and finally to Europe. On the Greek island of Corfu and on Sardinia, reed boats have survived to the present day. On Sardinia, there are now only small boats with cut-off sterns like those of ancient Nineveh, but they do have the exceptional buoyancy of all reed boats. From the islands of the inland sea, the reed boat penetrated the Straits of Gibraltar to the Atlantic Ocean. Here at Lixus, on the Atlantic coast of Africa, the Berbers still build reed boats on the very spot where the Phoenicians founded the city nearly 3,000 years ago.
I think that's a good place to stop. Just make sure that... There we go. We can't accidentally have an ad popping up or something. That's good. So, that was the expedition of one of the raw expeditions that were conducted from Africa to Barbados by Thor Heyerdahl, the first one of which failed because their papyrus boat was not seaworthy enough. I believe that's what happened. Well, we're going to see what happens in that story, but I mean, it seems to me to be a bit ambitious where he talks about, or where that narrator is talking about all these historical things about Egypt. It's very interesting, of course, which I just don't know how closely it ties in with the story of the papyrus. Well, it's very connected, you know, in the construction of the boat, but whether how it ties in with the history of Egypt is not really quite so clear, and it doesn't have much interest with regard to the chronology nowadays. It seems not according to the genealogy, for example, which. I mean, it doesn't connect with our genealogy exactly, but that's okay. September 16th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1940 hours Eastern Daylight Time in North America, and I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching, and in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie. They're saying bye for now. That was The Ark of Urartu, Chapter 2, Paragraph 2.